Mr. Cochrane, Reel 16. Now, we got to the point, this is attack on Briggs Peak, where you'd been captured, badly wounded, captured, and then it was obvious that the British the Sea Company's attack had failed, and the British artillery reopened their bombardment. I wonder if you could take up the story from there as to what happened.
Well, the first thing, of course, was when the barrage came down again, I knew that the attack, not just the company front, but the battalion attack and the battalion next to us, the whole attack obviously had failed. So I wasn't taking a great deal in, but at least I took that in. And the Italians were sheltering from the barrage, but it was rather like their barrages on us, because very steep peaks, and we only had 25 pounders, our artillery, rather than the big heavy mortars which the Italians had. So of course the shells that didn't burst on the so to speak, British side of the hill, although it wasn't in British hands, went whizzing over the top and pitched far, far down below the Italian defences, which were just beyond the crest, as you would expect. They looked after me. They went on for a bit, then stopped, and they patched me up a bit, sort of field dressings. And then when it got dark, or getting darker, they tried to get me and one other Cameron, Private Webster, in my company, who also was wounded, but comparatively slightly. One, his arm and an eye, I think, had been damaged, but he could walk. But they tried to get me down the hill their side, and I couldn't walk at all, of course. Then they got hold of a mule.
Now, hang on. Was this the first night or the second night that you...
The first night. This was the end of the day on which the attack had been made in the morning at first light. They put me on a mule, because like us, they used mules to get stuff up to the troops on the top. And I sort of fell off that two or three times. But by this time, we were down the hill a bit. And they got hold of a stretcher. So I was carried down in a stretcher as far as the railway line, which ran parallel to the road in the bottom of the cleft between Briggs Peak and the Sanshall, which was the next peak. Then there was a steep, steep ravine through which the road and the railway line ran. And on the Italian side of all this, there was a big tunnel, which was they used as, I suppose, a store, place for reinforcements, and also a place for casualties. So I was taken in there on my stretcher, and Webster with me, and we were given something to drink. We were treated really just exactly as though we had been wounded Italians. And, well, it's a sort of trifling point, but to indicate that how good they were, as I hope we would have been. I still had my watch on my wrist, and they didn't take it off. I mean, nobody sort of tried to pinch it or anything. And so we spent...
Now, what state were you in? Could you review your sort of wounds and the state you were in?
Well, I knew that I couldn't walk. And I knew that I could see, because my eyes had all been bunged up. I thought I'd been blinded when I was first hit. But this, in fact, actually was gravel and stuff thrown up from the hand grenade explosion. And I think the up in the aid post on top, the Italians had sort of tried to mop some of the gravel out, so I knew I could see. Equally, I knew that one arm was out of action. And, of course, by this time, the shock, which is always an anaesthetic, I noticed that with our chaps getting wounded, had long ago worn off, so the pain was acute. And it got even worse when a salvo of shells, our shells, landed at the sort of mouth of the tunnel. So there's great sort of huge noise. I mean, the noise was multiplied by the tunnel, and clouds of dust, and great yelling from everybody in the tunnel. And somebody dived for shelter on top of me, on top of the, as I lay in the stretcher. And then I passed out and really didn't know anything more until, again, still that night, I was taken from the railway line down the last little bit of the ravine and up the other side of the ravine, a third of the way, I suppose, where the motor road ran. And there they had two or three ambulances. And I was put in one of these and taken back, which turned out to be a sort of what we would have called, I suppose, a field hospital, a tented hospital. I was patched up a bit there, as was Webster, then I'm not sure whether it was the following night or two nights later, we went back in another ambulance trip as far as Asmara, which was the capital of Eritrea, capital city, and Italian HQ, Army HQ, where there was a hospital. I think that must have been a civilian hospital, but had been taken over by the army, and was full of Italian wounded. And there I found myself in a little room. There were three beds. There were two other officers who had been captured, not on our part of the Eritrean front, but in fact the other side of Ethiopia, and had been evacuated by the Italians to Asmara, to this hospital, probably 2 months earlier. And they could walk about. I mean, they were mobile. And it obviously, whether it had once been a civilian hospital, I don't know, but they must have allowed for rogues to be in it because there were bars on the window. It wasn't an ordinary hospital room. And there the again, I was well looked after. The problems they had was that since they had had no supplies ever since the Red Sea was shut to them, the outbreak of war, this hospital had hardly any anaesthetics of any description. And what they did have were kept entirely for amputations. And in my case, my wounds were dressed and everything was sort of fairly normal. In fact, meant both legs were sort of bandaged from top to bottom and my arm as well. But then I could smell myself. I got gangrene, not in the wounds in my arm, but in the wounds in my legs. And this meant a very, very painful process of daily being taken over to the operating theatre. And a chap sat on my feet, and another chap held my shoulders down, and I was given a slug of local homemade brandy and a chunk of bandage to chew or bite on, and the surgeon cut or snipped away all the rotting flesh around these something like 30-something different holes in my legs. And this really was a very painful process, and so painful that each day I used to start weeping to myself about an hour before I knew that they'd come to fetch me, to take me to the place. Webster I lost sight of. I think his wounds must have been well enough, cured sufficiently for him to be, whether he was still in the sort of walking wounded area, or whether he'd been passed on down to a prisoner of war camp, I don't know. Then the next thing was that the surgeon came to see me in this little prison ward, and in my Italian was practically nil, his English ditto, so we conversed in very bad French. But he told me that he thought that the only way I could survive was by having both my legs taken off right up at the top. And if this didn't happen, he thought there was no way they'd actually clear up the gangrene, and I'd probably die of that. But it was up to me, which was very decent of him to give me the choice. And I was rational enough to think that spending the rest of one's life sort of on the equivalent of casters would be no life at all. So I said I'd take a chance and not have the amputation. So this daily business of cutting the rotting bits off went on. I, of course, had ceased to smell myself. I mean, the stink was so awful that I got inured to it. But the other two chaps locked up all every night in this ward, it must have been really appalling for them.
Well, no, just one thing. We haven't covered it yet, but you were interrogated as well. Can we just... I think that was actually at the field hospital, but yeah. Can we just ask you about that?
Yeah, that went back to when I was still in the field hospital, and when they were doing the sort of preliminary dressings on things, which, again, was pretty painful. And I suppose it was a smart thing to do, but I got irritated as well as feeling the pain when an intelligence officer began quizzing me in very good English about what was my regiment and what was the division and so on. And you'd always been told in the army that the only information you could give if you were taken prisoner was name, rank and army number. So I stuck to the book, and I think my army number, there must have been on identity disc around my neck, so they knew that. But before the battle, we'd been told to leave off. I mean, we weren't wearing our little brass Cameron shoulder things that were fixed on our shirts. We weren't even told not to wear our red flashes and our garters, which showed that we were a Scottish or a Highland regiment. So he questioned me in vain. I came back some time later to say that they'd tried to give, or succeeded in giving Private Webster a bit of a clean-up, including taking his shirt off, which was in tatters, I think. And he was an old sweat, served in India, like a lot of the regular soldiers in India, I suppose out of boredom really, had got themselves tattooed. And he had a tremendous regimental display all over his chest. He was, the intelligence officer came back and said, "Well, I know exactly that your patron saint is Saint Andrew, and your motto is Nemo Meum Pune Lacessit, and the badge is on his chest is Cameron's, and a lot of other stuff about his girlfriends on his arms too." So Private Webster's tattooing defeated the the object of name, rank and number only. I think they were very correct to try and get the information. I don't think it added anything to what they probably already knew. But I did feel a bit miffed that he chose the time when the wounds were being dressed to ask the question. But that was the only, if you like, it wasn't a bad thing to do, but it was the only thing I really could have taken exception to in the way they behaved to me. I lost my watch eventually because it actually was, it turned out it was really holding my wrist together. So to put the wrist right, they had to get the watch off. And the thing was then in plaster and bandaged up. And I don't know, I suppose one of the hospital orderlies must have pocketed it. But it certainly wasn't pinched by the Savoy Grenadiers, who was a regiment that took me prisoner. And then some weeks elapsed.
How long? It's not clear in the book. I mean, you were captured on the 20th of March. Would it be how far into April are we?
It would have been towards the end of April, certainly into the second half of April. I think I was only in that hospital about 4 weeks. Then the advance continued, and you could tell that something was up. Asmara was looked on as an open town by the British. It wasn't bombed or anything. But the Italians were busy burning stores, and clouds of smoke you could see through the bars of the windows. And then the next thing was an Indian Army medical corps hospital, again a field hospital, took over. And they, of course, had all the anaesthetics and anything you could wish for. Equally, they could... the colonel in charge, an Indian medical officer, very elegant, white-haired man, and I could tell I still stunk by his face as he sort of bent over to look at my legs. So immediately I was operated on with a great dose of real anaesthetic, a knockout, and instead of, I suppose, tinkering with little bits of rotting meat, they did a thorough job on it. And then also, I imagine, that they did have whether penicillin had been invented by then, I don't know, or whether it was available, but certainly they must have had disinfectants powerful enough to make sure that the gangrene never came back. So it was... from thereafter, I was laid in a bath every day until which I badly needed quay bath, but also it was useful because I just left in it until all the dressings had floated off under their own accord, because it was I couldn't have faced them all being sort of picked off, peeled off. And there I stayed in that hospital. The Indian Army field hospital moved on as the advance moved on, and a general hospital took over with British nurses and matrons and all the rest of it, but it was by that time, I was really on the way to recovery, still not walking much, or if at all. But the people that really did the trick were the Italian surgeon in the first instance, and then the Indian Army Medical Corps, who were, of course, if you like, our meaning the 4th Indian Division, our field hospital. So it was all part of the family.
It was the 4th Indian Division that had arrived, was it?
Yes, yes. Eventually, after our failure, they employed a corps, 2 divisions, the 5th Indian Division, which had been in a different part of Eritrea. They were brought up, and the final attack was both on the hill or hills that we had been attacking and on the other side of the big ravine. And in the course of all that, those battles or attacks on either side, the HLI, Highland Light Infantry, from the 5th Indian Division, they got through the tunnel, which, not the one I'd been sheltered in by the Italians, but the one that was on what then became known as Cameron Ridge after C Company had captured it at the very beginning of the battle. They got through that tunnel and therefore were able to surprise the Italians, who were down by the roadblock. Beyond that, it was beyond that roadblock, of course, that the Italian ambulances had functioned. Such a successful, brilliant engineers, the Italians, and there was no way you could have cleared the road, so the Indian sappers merely built a new road over the top of the roadblock, which was much quicker than trying to do anything else. And the commander of the Italian forces was killed. He was a brilliant general. And we noticed in the desert that where again, in 2 of our actions, the Italian commander had been killed by chance, by a shell burst. And that when that happened, they seemed to lose heart. But indeed, they, even apart from that, they clearly had lost the battle to hold this strong point and withdrew, and eventually never stopped in Asmara, because there was no possible battlefield there, right back to northern Ethiopia, where the Duke of Aosta, who was the governor and commander-in-chief, tried to make a last stand there with the troops drawn back from Eritrea, the ones who were up against us, and the ones who had been in Ethiopia. And eventually, I mean, he was surrounded there, and he surrendered with his troops. So I went on spending, I was in that hospital, walking a bit, and for, I suppose, another couple of months, and getting out.
So round about June?
Yes. Then I was still getting around on 2 sticks, but didn't need to be in the hospital proper. So I was allowed to go join another 2 or 3 officers in a billet in Asmara town itself. And I think I probably still had to check in once a week or so to the hospital. But then I was just waiting. I was told that at some point or another I'd be evacuated from Eritrea. And eventually in August, I and 1 or 2 other wounded or ex-wounded people were shipped off from Massawa, which is was the Eritrean port on the Red Sea, in a funny little Egyptian steamer up to Suez, where we got onto a liner. I've forgotten now.
Before we go into that, just because you were given the DSO.
Oh,
because that was before you left Asmara. Could you just tell us that story? It's quite a good story.
Well, yes, I was told first of all, which I was in a cinema in Asmara, when the general commanding, his ADC, whom I knew faint slightly, he was a HLI officer, he knew I'd gone to the Flicks, and he dug me out of the cinema and said, the general's sent me to tell you that you've been awarded the DSO, which was rather flabbergasted. 6 hours only a second lieutenant, you see. But anyhow, that was that. And then Wavell came to visit, well, in theory, to congratulate the troops after Kerin and after the Aosta surrender. But actually, I realise now with hindsight, of course, realised fairly early on, that what Wavell really wanted to see for himself on the spot was how quickly all the troops that were still in Eritrea could be shipped back to the desert, because he was desperately short of soldiers there. But while he was in Asmara, there was a parade of the sort of small garrison troops, which mostly consisted of Indian soldiers, an Indian regiment. A VC was pinned onto a chap called Bhagat Singh, who was a sapper. I think the Bombay or Madras Sappers and Miners. Anyhow, he was awarded the VC for a marvellous piece of clearing mines, where a bridge had been blown, the road bridge, and over a then dried up riverbed, and the riverbed was absolutely peppered with mines laid by the Italians to delay the advance, which it did, but it delayed it a great deal longer if this chap, Bhagat Singh, hadn't by himself and under shell fire crawled around finding, locating and disarming the mines, and went on doing that until he'd cleared a passageway wide enough to get troops and also, above all, 3-ton lorries through. This was before we ever reached the battlefield of Kerin. So Wavell pinned the ribbon of the VC onto Bhagat Singh, and then I was paraded to have my ribbon pinned on in a few words. But the embarrassing thing was that I had had the previous day the most stupendous attack of Jippy Tummy, and really a sort of dysentery, I suppose. But I know the old family remedy I used, which was to pour some brandy into a flattish thing and put a match to it, as though you were thinking of Christmas turkey or something, or Christmas pudding. And then after it had burnt and stopped burning, pour the burnt brandy into, if you didn't want to burn your mouth, into another cup, or, and then swig it down. And the burning removes something or other, the esters or something, or the alcohol, and leaves something else. But it really is, it's a marvellous remedy against Jippy Tummy or the trots. And so I, still having had the trots all night, I gave myself a good dollop of the family remedy. And so I could parade all right, managed no problems with the parade, except, of course, that I was stinking of brandy. So Wavell must have thought I was a pretty hard case second lieutenant to be stinking of brandy at 8 a.m. in the morning. I think that's when the parade was.
Now, what about the journey? Originally you were going to South Africa. But
yes. That was uneventful. It was a comfortable ship. I think the whole ship was filled with invalids of one sort or another. It certainly wasn't carrying